The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Greetings, listeners, and welcome to a special episode of Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host, and I hope you've got your necromantic stomping boots on, friends, because tonight, we're closing out this season with The Colossus of Alorn by Clark Ashton Smith. For those of you unfamiliar with Smith, he was a weird fiction author and contemporary of Lovecraft, Howard, and other names that frequented the covers of Weird Tales. Tonight's story, published in 1934, manages to reach across the intervening decades and sound a clarion call to absurd battle. An infamous local wizard, along with his 10 devil-given pupils, has recently disappeared. While that might seem beneficial for the surrounding region of Averoigne, dark portents are seen in the sky, and strange lights and sounds are noticed in the long-abandoned castle of Alorn. Who better to investigate this mystery than Gaspard Dunord, a former student of the missing sorcerer who turned from the path of darkness? You know, I'm all about that appropriate atmosphere, so tonight, listeners, instead of pouring yourself a classy beverage, lighting some candles, and settling in for a spooky evening, I expect you to crack open the shittiest beer you've got, throw some Iron Maiden on in the background, and break out your old 20-sided dice. I think it's time to get colossing. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Clark Ashton Smith, I give you The Colossus of Alorn. One, The Flight of the Necromancer. The thrice infamous Nathair, alchemist, astrologer, and necromancer, with his 10 devil-given pupils, had departed very suddenly and under circumstances of strict secrecy from the town of Vionne. It was widely thought, among the people of that vicinage, that his departure had been prompted by a salutary fear of ecclesiastical thumbscrews. Other wizards, less notorious than he, had already gone to the stake during a year of unusual inquisitory zeal. And it was well known that Nathair had incurred the reprobation of the church. Few, therefore, considered the reason of his going a mystery, but the means of transit which he had employed, as well as the destination of the sorcerer and his pupils, were regarded as more than problematic. 1,000 dark and superstitious rumors were abroad, and passers made the sign of the cross when they neared the tall, gloomy house which Nethere had built in blasphemous proximity to the great cathedral and had filled with a furniture of satanic luxury and strangeness. Two daring thieves, who had entered the mansion when the fact of its desertion became well established, reported that much of this furniture, as well as the books and other paraphernalia of Nethere, had seemingly departed with its owner, doubtless to the same fiery bourne. This served to augment the unholy mystery, for it was patently impossible that Nethere and his 10 apprentices, with several cartloads of household belongings, could have passed the ever-guarded city gates in any legitimate manner without the knowledge of the custodians. It was said by the more devout and religious moiety that the archfiend, with a legion of bat-winged assistants, had borne them away bodily at moonless midnight. There were clerics and also reputable burghers who professed to have seen the flight of man-like shapes upon the blotted stars together with others that were not men, and to have heard the wailing cries of the hell-bound crew as they passed in an evil cloud over the roofs and city walls. Others believed that the sorcerers had transported themselves from Vionne through their own diabolic arts and had withdrawn to some unfrequented fastness where Nethere, who had long been in feeble health, could hope to die in such peace and serenity as might be enjoyed by one who stood between the flames of the auto-da-fé and those of Abaddon. It was thought that he had lately cast his own horoscope for the first time in his 50-odd years, and had read therein an impending conjunction of disastrous planets signifying early death. Others still, among whom were certain rival astrologers and enchanters, said that Nethere had retired from the public view merely that he might commune without interruption with various coadjutive demons, and thus might weave, unmolested, the black spells of a supreme and lycanthropic malice. These spells, they hinted, would in due time be visited upon Vionne and perhaps upon the entire region of Averroigne, and would no doubt take the form of a fearsome pestilence, or a wholesale invultuation, or a realm-wide incursion of succubi and incubi. Amid the seething of strange rumors, many half-forgotten tales were recalled, and new legends were created overnight. Much was made of the obscure nativity of Nethere and his dubitable wanderings before he had settled, 6 years previous, in Vionne. People said that he was fiend-begotten, like the fabled Merlin, his father being no less a personage than Alistair, demon of revenge, and his mother a deformed and dwarfish sorceress. From the former, he had taken his spitefulness and malignity, from the latter, his squat, puny physique. He had traveled in Orient lands and had learned from Egyptian and Saracenic masters the unhallowed art of necromancy, in whose practice he was unrivaled. There were black whispers anent the use he had made of long-dead bodies, of fleshless bones, and the service he had wrung from buried men that the Angel of Doom alone could lawfully raise up. He had never been popular, though many had sought his advice and assistance in the furthering of their own more or less dubious affairs. Once, in the third year after his coming to Vionne, he had been stoned in public because of his brooded necromancies and had been permanently lamed by a well-directed cobble. This injury, it was thought, he had never forgiven, and he was said to return the antagonism of the clergy with the hellish hatred of an antichrist. Apart from the sorcerous evils and abuses of which he was commonly suspected, he had long been looked upon as a corrupter of youth. Despite his minikin stature, his deformity, and ugliness, he possessed a remarkable power, a mesmeric persuasion, and his pupils, whom he was said to have plunged into bottomless and ghoulish iniquities, were young men of the most brilliant promise. On the whole, his vanishment was regarded as a quite providential riddance. Among the people of the city, there was one man who took no part in the somber gossip and lurid speculation. This man was Gaspard du Nord, himself a student of the proscribed sciences, who had been numbered for a year among the pupils of Nethere, but had chosen to withdraw quietly from the master's household after learning the enormities that would attend his further initiation. He had, however, taken with him much rare and peculiar knowledge, together with a certain insight into the baleful powers and night-dark motives of the necromancer. Because of this knowledge and insight, Gaspard preferred to remain silent when he heard of Nathair's departure. Also, he did not think it well to revive the memory of his own past pupilage. Alone with his books in a sparsely furnished attic, he frowned above a small, oblong mirror framed with an arabesque of golden vipers that had once been the property of Nathair. It was not the reflection of his own comely and youthful, though subtly lined face that caused him to frown. Indeed, the mirror was of another kind than that which reflects the features of the gazer. In its depths, for a few instants, he had beheld a strange and ominous-looking scene, whose participants were known to him, but whose location he could not recognize or orientate. Before he could study it closely, the mirror had clouded as if with the rising of alchemic fumes, and he had seen no more. This clouding, he reflected, could mean only one thing. Nathair had known himself watched and had put forth a counterspell that rendered the clairvoyant mirror useless. It was the realization of this fact, together with the brief, sinister glimpse of Nathair's present activities, that troubled Gaspard and caused a chill horror to mount slowly in his mind. A horror that had not yet found a palpable form or a name. 2. The Gathering of the Dead. The departure of Nathair and his pupils occurred in the late spring of 1281, during the interlunar dark. Afterwards, a new moon waxed above the flowery fields and bright-leafed woods, and waned in ghostly silver. With its waning, people began to talk of other magicians and fresher mysteries. Then, in the moon-deserted nights of early summer, there came a series of disappearances far more unnatural and inexplicable than that of the dwarfish, malignant sorcerer. It was found one day by gravediggers who had gone early to their toil in a cemetery outside the walls of Vionne that no less than 6 newly occupied graves had been opened and the bodies, which were those of reputable citizens, removed. On closer examination, it became all too evident that this removal had not been effected by robbers. The coffins, which lay aslant or stood protruding upright from the mold, offered all the appearance of having been shattered from within, as if by the use of extra human strength. And the fresh earth itself was upheaved, as if the dead men, in some awful, untimely resurrection, had actually dug their way to the surface. The corpses had vanished utterly, as if hell had swallowed them, and, as far as could be learned, there were no eyewitnesses of their fate. In those devil-ridden times, only one explanation of the happening seemed credible. Demons had entered the graves and had taken bodily possession of the dead, compelling them to arise and go forth. To the dismay and horror of all Averroine, the strange vanishment was followed with appalling promptness by many others of a like sort. It seemed as if an occult, resistless summons had been laid upon the dead. Nightly, for a period of 2 weeks, the cemeteries of Vionne and also those of other towns, of villages and hamlets, gave up a ghastly quota of their tenants. From brazen bolted tombs, from common charnels, from shallow, unconsecrated trenches, from the marble-lidded vaults of churches and cathedrals, the weird exodus went on without cessation. Worse than this, if possible, there were newly cerimented corpses that leapt from the biers and catafalques and, disregarding the horrified watchers, ran with great bounds of automatic frenzy into the night, never to be seen again by those who lamented them. In every case, the missing bodies were those of young, stalwart men who had died but recently and had met their death through violence or accident rather than wasting illness. Some were criminals who had paid the penalty of their misdeeds. Others were men-at-arms or constables slain in the execution of their duty. Knights who had died in tourney or personal combat were numbered among them, and many were the victims of the robber bands who infested Averroine at that time. There were monks, merchants, nobles, yeomen, pages, priests, but none in any case who had passed the prime of life. The old and infirm, it seemed, were safe from the animating demons. The situation was looked upon by the more superstitious as a veritable omening of the world's end. Satan was making war with his cohorts and was carrying the bodies of the holy dead into hellish captivity. The consternation increased a hundredfold when it became plain that even the most liberal sprinkling of holy water, the performance of the most awful and cogent exorcisms, failed utterly to give protection against this diabolic ravishment. The church owned itself powerless to cope with the strange evil, and the forces of secular law could do nothing to arraign or punish the intangible agency. Because of the universal fear that prevailed, no effort was made to follow the missing cadavers. Ghastly tales, however, were told by late wayfarers who had met certain of these leches, striding alone or in companies along the roads of Averoigne. They gave the appearance of being deaf, dumb, totally insensate, and of hurrying with horrible speed and sureness towards a remote, predestined goal. The general direction of their flight, it seemed, was eastward, but only with the cessation of the exodus, which had numbered several hundred people, did anyone begin to suspect the actual destination of the dead. This destination, it somehow became rumored, was the ruinous castle of Alorn, beyond the werewolf-haunted forest, in the outlying, semi-mountainous hills of Averoigne. Alorn, a great, craggy pile that had been built by a line of evil and marauding barons now extinct, was a place that even goatherds preferred to shun. The wrathful specters of its bloody lords were said to move turbulently in its crumbling halls, and its chatelains were the undead. No one cared to dwell in the shadow of its cliff-founded walls, and the nearest abode of living men was a small Cistercian monastery more than a mile away on the opposite slope of the valley. The monks of this austere brotherhood held little commerce with the world beyond the hills, and few were the visitors who sought admission at their high-perched portals. But during that dreadful summer following the disappearances of the dead, a weird and disquieting tale went forth from the monastery throughout Averoigne. Beginning with late spring, the Cistercian monks were compelled to take cognizance of sundry odd phenomena in the old, long-deserted ruins of Alorn, which were visible from their windows. They had beheld flaring lights where lights should not have been, flames of uncanny blue and crimson that shuddered behind the broken, weed-grown embrasures or rose starwards above the jagged crenellations. Hideous noises had issued from the ruin by night together with the flames, and the monks had heard a clangor as of hellish anvils and hammers, a ringing of gigantic armor and maces, and had deemed that Alorn was become a mustering ground of devils. Mephitic odors as of brimstone and burning flesh had floated across the valley, and even by day, when the noises were silent and the lights no longer flared, a thin haze of hell-blue vapor hung upon the battlements. It was plain, the monks thought, that the place had been occupied from beneath by subterrestrial beings, for no one was seen to approach it by way of the bare, open slopes and crags. Observing these signs of the arch-foe's activity in their neighborhood, they crossed themselves with new fervor and frequency, and said their paters and aves more interminably than before. Their toil and austerities also they redoubled. Otherwise, since the old castle was a place abandoned by men, they took no heed of the supposed occupation, deeming it well to mind their own affairs, unless in case of overt satanic hostility. They kept a careful watch, but for several weeks they saw no one who actually entered Alorn or emerged therefrom, except for the nocturnal lights and noises and the hovering vapor by day. There was no proof of tenantry, either human or diabolic. Then, one morning, in the valley below the terraced gardens of the monastery, two brothers, hoeing weeds in a carrot patch, beheld the passing of a singular train of people who came from the direction of the great forest of Averoigne and went upwards, climbing the steep, chasmy slope towards Alorn. These people, the monks averred, were striding along in great haste, with stiff but flying steps, and all were strangely pale of feature and were habited in the garments of the grave. The shrouds of some were torn and ragged, and all were dusty with travel or grimed with the mold of interment. The people numbered a dozen or more, and after them, at intervals, there came several stragglers, attired like the rest. With marvelous agility and speed, they mounted the hill and disappeared at length amid the lowering walls of Alorn. At this time, no rumor of the ravished graves and biers had reached the Cistercians. The tale was brought to them later, after they had beheld, on many successive mornings, the passing of small or great companies of the dead towards the devil-taken castle. Hundreds of the liches, they swore, had filed by beneath the monastery, and doubtless many others had gone past unnoted in the dark. None, however, were seen to come forth from Alorn, which had swallowed them up like the undisgorging pit. Though direly frightened and sorely scandalized, the brothers still thought it well to refrain from action. Some, the hardiest, irked by all these flagrant signs of evil, had desired to visit the ruins with holy water and lifted crucifixes. But their abbot, in his wisdom, enjoined them to wait. In the meanwhile, the nocturnal flames grew brighter, the noises louder. Also, in the course of this waiting, while incessant prayers went up from the little monastery, a frightful thing occurred. One of the brothers, a stout fellow named Théophile, in violation of the rigorous discipline, had made over-frequent visits to the wine casks. No doubt he had tried to drown his pious horror at these untoward happenings. At any rate, after his potations, he had the ill luck to wander out among the precipices and break his neck. Sorrowing for his death and dereliction, the brothers laid Théophile in the chapel and chanted their masses for his soul. These masses, in the dark hours before morning, were interrupted by the untimely resurrection of the dead monk, who, with his head lolling horribly on his broken neck, rushed as if fiend-ridden from the chapel and ran down the hill towards the demon flames and clamors of Alorn. 3. The Testimony of the Monks. Following the above-related occurrence, two of the brothers who had previously desired to visit the haunted castle again applied to the abbot for this permission, saying that God would surely aid them in avenging the abduction of Théophile's body, as well as the taking of many others from consecrated ground. Marveling at the hardihood of these lusty monks, who proposed to beard the archenemy in his lair, the abbot permitted them to go forth, furnished with aspergillus and flasks of holy water, and bearing great crosses of hornbeam, such as would have served for maces with which to brain an armored knight. The monks, whose names were Bernard and Stefan, went boldly up at middle forenoon to assail the evil stronghold. It was an arduous climb, among overhanging boulders and among slippery scarps, but both were stout and agile, and moreover, well accustomed to such climbing. Since the day was sultry and airless, their white robes were soon stained with sweat, but pausing only for brief prayer, they pressed on, and in good season they neared the castle, upon whose gray, time-eroded ramparts they could still descry no evidence of occupation or activity. The deep moat that had once surrounded the place was now dry, and had been partly filled by crumbling earth and detritus from the walls. The drawbridge had rotted away, but the blocks of the barbican, collapsing into the moat, had made a sort of rough causeway on which it was possible to cross. Not without trepidation, and lifting their crucifixes as warriors lift their weapons in the escalade of an armed fortress, the brothers climbed over the ruin of the barbican into the courtyard. This, too, like the battlements, was seemingly deserted. Overgrown nettles, rank grasses, and sapling trees were rooted between its paving stones. The high, massive donjon, the chapel, and that portion of the castellated structure containing the great hall had preserved their main outlines after centuries of dilapidation. To the left of the broad bailey, a doorway yawned like the mouth of a dark cavern in the cliffy mass of the hall building. And from this doorway, there issued a thin, bluish vapor, writhing in phantom coils towards the unclouded heavens. Approaching the doorway, the brothers beheld a gleaming of red fires within, like the eyes of dragons blinking through infernal murk. They felt sure that the place was an outpost of Erebus, an antechamber of the pit, but nevertheless they entered bravely, chanting loud exorcisms and brandishing their mighty crosses of hornbeam. Passing through the cavernous doorway, They could see but indistinctly in the gloom, being somewhat blinded by the summer sunlight they had left. Then, with a gradual clearing of their vision, a monstrous scene was limned before them, with ever-growing details of crowding horror and grotesquery. Some of the details were obscure and mysteriously terrifying. Others, all too plain, were branded as if with sudden, ineffaceable hellfire on the minds of the monks. They stood on the threshold of a colossal chamber, which seemed to have been made by the tearing down of upper floors and inner partitions adjacent to the castle hall, itself a room of huge extent. The chamber seemed to recede through interminable shadow, shafted with sunlight falling through the rents of ruin, sunlight that was powerless to dissipate the infernal gloom and mystery. The monks averred later that they saw many people moving about the place, together with sundry demons, some of whom were shadowy and gigantic, and others barely to be distinguished from the men. These people, as well as their familiars, were occupied with the tending of reverberatory furnaces and immense pear-shaped and gourd-shaped vessels such as were used in alchemy. Some, also, were stooping above great fuming cauldrons like sorcerers, busy with the brewing of terrible drugs. Against the opposite wall, there were two enormous vats built of stone and mortar, whose circular sides rose higher than a man's head, so that Bernard and Stefan were unable to determine their contents. One of the vats gave forth a whitish glimmering, the other a ruddy luminosity. Near the vats, and somewhat between them, there stood a sort of low couch or litter made of luxurious, weirdly figured fabrics such as the Saracens weave. On this, the monks discerned a dwarfish being, pale and wizened, with eyes of chill flame that shone like evil barrels through the dusk. The dwarf, who had all the air of a feeble moribund, was supervising the toils of the men and their familiars. The dazed eyes of the brothers began to comprehend other details. They saw that several corpses, among which they recognized that of Théophile, were lying in the middle floor, together with a heap of human bones that had been wrenched asunder at the joints, and great lumps of flesh piled like the carvings of butchers. One of the men was lifting the bones and dropping them into a cauldron beneath which there glowed a ruby-colored fire, and another was flinging the lumps of flesh into a tub filled with some hueless liquid that gave forth an evil hissing as of a thousand serpents. Others had stripped the grave clothes from one of the cadavers and were starting to assail it with long knives. Others still were mounting rude flights of stone stairs along the walls of the immense vats, carrying vessels filled with semi-liquescent matters which they emptied over the high rims. Appalled at this vision of human and satanic turpitude, and feeling a more than righteous indignation, the monks resumed their chanting of sonorous exorcisms and rushed forward. Their entrance, it appeared, was not perceived by the heinously occupied crew of sorcerers and devils. Bernard and Stefan, filled with an ardor of godly wrath, were about to fling themselves upon the butchers who had started to assail the dead body. This corpse they recognized as being that of a notorious outlaw named Jacques Le Loup Garou, who had been slain a few days previous in combat with the officers of the state. Le Loup Garou, noted for his brawn, his cunning, and his ferocity, had long terrorized the woods and highways of Averoigne. His great body had been half eviscerated by the swords of the constabulary, and his beard was stiff and purple with the dried blood of a ghastly wound that had cloven his face from temple to mouth. He had died unshriven, but nevertheless, the monks were unwilling to see his helpless cadaver put to some unhallowed use beyond the surmise of Christians. The pale, malignant-looking dwarf had now perceived the brothers. They heard him cry out in a shrill, imperatory tone that rose above the ominous hiss of the cauldrons and the hoarse mutter of men and demons. They knew not his words, which were those of some outlandish tongue and sounded like an incantation. Instantly, as if in response to an order, two of the men turned from their unholy chemistry and, lifting copper basins filled with an unknown, fetid liquor, hurled the contents of these vessels in the faces of Bernard and Stefan. The brothers were blinded by the stinging fluid, which bit their flesh as with many serpents' teeth, and they were overcome by the noxious fumes, so that their great crosses dropped from their hands, and they both fell unconscious on the castle floor. Recovering anon their sight and their other senses, they found that their hands had been tied with heavy thongs of gut, so that they were now helpless and could no longer wield their crucifixes or the sprinklers of holy water which they carried. In this ignominious condition, they heard the voice of the evil dwarf commanding them to arise. They obeyed, though clumsily and with difficulty, being denied the assistance of their hands. Bernard, who was still sick with the poisonous vapor he had inhaled, fell twice before he succeeded in standing erect, and his discomfiture was greeted with a cacophony of foul, obscene laughter from the assembled sorcerers. Now, standing, the monks were taunted by the dwarf, who mocked and reviled them with appalling blasphemies such as could be uttered only by a bondservant of Satan. At last, according to their sworn testimony, he said to them, "Return to your kennel, ye whelps of Yaldabaoth, and take with you this message. They that come here as many shall go forth as one." Then, in obedience to a dreadful formula spoken by the dwarf, two of the familiars, who had the shape of enormous and shadowy beasts, approached the body of Le Loup Garou and that of Brother Théophile. One of the foul demons, like a vapor that sinks into a marsh, entered the bloody nostrils of Le Loup Garou, disappearing inch by inch till its horned and bestial head was withdrawn from sight. The other, in like manner, went in through the nostrils of Brother Théophile, whose head lay weird athwart his shoulders on the broken neck. Then, when the demons had completed their possession, the bodies, in a fashion horrible to behold, were raised up from the castle floor, the one with raveled entrails hanging from its wide wounds, the other with a head that dropped forward loosely on its bosom. Then, animated by their devils, the cadavers took up the crosses of hornbeam that had been dropped by Stefan and Bernard, and using the crosses for bludgeons, they drove the monks in ignominious flight from the castle amid a loud, tempestuous howling of infernal laughter from the dwarf and his necromantic crew. And the nude corpse of Le Loup Garou and the robed cadaver of Théophile followed them far on the chasm-riven slopes below Elorn, striking great blows with the crosses, so that the backs of the two Cistercians were become a mass of bloody bruises. After a defeat so signal and crushing, no more of the monks were emboldened to go up against Elorn. The whole monastery, thereafter, devoted itself to triple austerities, to quadrupled prayers, and awaiting the unknown will of God and the equally obscure machinations of the devil, maintained a pious faith that was somewhat tempered with trepidation. In time, through goatherds who visited the monks, the tale of Stefan and Bernard went forth throughout Averoigne, adding to the grievous alarm that had been caused by the wholesale disappearance of the dead. No one knew what was really going on in the haunted castle, or what disposition had been made of the hundreds of migratory corpses, for the light thrown on their fate by the monk's story, though lurid and frightful, was all too inconclusive, and the message sent by the dwarf was somewhat cabalistic. Everyone felt, however, that some gigantic menace, some black, infernal enchantment, was being brewed within the ruinous walls. The malign, moribund dwarf was all too readily identified with the missing sorcerer, Nether, and his underlings, it was plain, were Nether's pupils. 4. The Going Forth of Gaspard du Nord. Alone in his attic chamber, Gaspard du Nord, student of alchemy and sorcery and quondam pupil of Nether, sought repeatedly, but always in vain, to consult the viper-circled mirror. The glass remained obscure and cloudy, as with arisen fumes of satanical alembics or baleful necromantic braziers. Haggard and weary with long nights of watching, Gaspard knew that Nether was even more vigilant than he. Reading with anxious care the general configuration of the stars, he found the foretokening of a great evil that was to come upon Averoigne, but the nature of the evil was not clearly shown. In the meantime, the hideous resurrection and migration of the dead was taking place. All Averroine shuddered at the manifold enormity. Like the timeless night of a Memphian plague, terror settled everywhere, and people spoke of each new atrocity in bated whispers without daring to voice the execrable tale aloud. To Gaspard, as to everyone, the whispers came, and likewise, after the horror had apparently ceased in early midsummer, there came the appalling story of the Cistercian monks. Now, at last, the long-baffled watcher found an inkling of that which he sought. The hiding place of the fugitive necromancer and his apprentices, at least, had been uncovered, and the disappearing dead were clearly traced to their bourne. But still, even for the percipient Gaspard, there remained an undeclared enigma. The exact nature of the abominable brew, the hell-dark sorcery that Nethair was concocting in his remote den. Gaspard felt sure of one thing only. The dying, splenetic dwarf, knowing that his allotted time was short and hating the people of Averroine with a bottomless rancor, would prepare an enormous and maleficent magic without parallel. Even with his knowledge of Nethair's proclivities and his awareness of the well-nigh inexhaustible arcanic science, the reserves of pit-deep wizardry possessed by the dwarf, he could form only vague, terrifical conjectures anent the incubated evil. But as time went on, he felt an ever-deepening oppression, the adumbration of a monstrous menace crawling from the dark rim of the world. He could not shake off his disquietude, and finally, he resolved, despite the obvious perils of such an excursion, to pay a secret visit to the neighborhood of Alorn. Gaspard, though he came of a well-to-do family, was at that time in straitened circumstances, for his devotion to a somewhat doubtful science had been disapproved by his father. His sole income was a small pittance purveyed secretly to the youth by his mother and sister. This sufficed for his meager food, the rent of his room, and a few books and instruments and chemicals, but it would not permit the purchase of a horse or even a humble mule for the proposed journey of more than 40 miles. Undaunted, he set forth on foot, carrying only a dagger and a wallet of food. He timed his wanderings so that he would reach Alorn at nightfall in the rising of a full moon. Much of his journey lay through the great lowering forest, which approached the very walls of Vionne on the eastern side and ran in a somber arc through Averroine to the mouth of the rocky valley below Alorn. After a few miles, he emerged from the mighty wood of pines and oaks and larches, and thenceforward, for the first day, followed the river Isoil through an open, well-peopled plain. He spent the warm summer night beneath a beech tree in the vicinity of a small village, not caring to sleep in the lonely woods where robbers and wolves, and creatures of a more baleful repute, were commonly supposed to dwell. At evening of the second day, after passing through the wildest and oldest portion of the immemorial wood, he came to the steep, stony valley that led to his destination. This valley was the fountainhead of the Isoil, which had dwindled to a mere rivulet. In the brown twilight, between sunset and moonrise, he saw the lights of the Cistercian monastery, and opposite, on the piled, forbidding scarps, the grim and rugged mass of the ruinous stronghold of Alorn, with wan and wizard fires flickering behind its high embrasures. Apart from these fires, there was no sign of occupation, and he did not hear at any time the dismal noises reported by the monks. Gaspard waited till the round moon, yellow as the eye of some immense nocturnal bird, had begun to peer above the darkling valley. Then, very cautiously, since the neighborhood was strange to him, he started to make his way towards the somber, brooding castle. Even for one well used to such climbing, the escalade would have offered enough difficulty and danger by moonlight. Several times, finding himself at the bottom of a sheer cliff, he was compelled to retrace his hard-won progress, and often he was saved from falling only by stunted shrubs and briars that had taken root in the niggard soil. Breathless, with torn raiment and scored and bleeding hands, he gained at length the shoulder of the craggy height below the walls. Here, he paused to recover breath and recuperate his flagging strength. He could see, from his vantage, the pale reflection as of hidden flames that beat upwards on the inner walls of the high-built donjon. He heard a low hum of confused noises, whose distance and direction were alike baffling. Sometimes they seemed to float downwards from the black battlements, sometimes to issue from subterranean depths far in the hill. Apart from this remote, ambiguous hum, the night was locked in a mortal stillness. The very winds appeared to shun the vicinity of the dread castle. An unseen, clammy cloud of paralyzing evil hung removeless upon all things, and the pale, swollen moon, the patroness of witches and sorcerers, distilled her green poison above the crumbling towers in a silence older than time. Gaspard felt the obscenely clinging weight of a more burdenous thing than his own fatigue when he resumed his progress towards the barbican. Invisible webs of the waiting, ever-gathering evil seemed to impede him. The slow, noisome flapping of intangible wings was heavy in his face. He seemed to breathe a surging wind from unfathomable vaults and caverns of corruption. Inaudible howlings, derisive or minatory, thronged in his ears, and foul hands appeared to thrust him back. But, bowing his head as if against a blowing gale, he went on and climbed the mounded ruin of the barbican into the weedy courtyard. The place was deserted to all seeming, and much of it was still deep in the shadows of the walls and turrets. Nearby, in the black, silver-crenellated pile, Gaspard saw the open, cavernous doorway described by the monks. It was lit from within by a lurid glare, wannish and eerie as marsh fires. The humming noise, now audible as a muttering of voices, issued from the doorway, and Gaspard thought that he could see dark, sooty figures moving rapidly in the lit interior. Keeping in the farther shadows, he stole along the courtyard, making a sort of circuit amid the ruins. He did not dare to approach the open entrance for fear of being seen, though, as far as he could tell, the place was unguarded. He came to the donjon, on whose upper wall the wan light flickered obliquely through a sort of rift in the long building adjacent. This opening was at some distance from the ground, and Gaspard saw that it had been formerly the door to a stony balcony. A flight of broken steps led upward along the wall to the half-crumbled remnant of this balcony, and it occurred to the youth that he might climb the steps and peer unobserved into the interior of Alorn. Some of the stairs were missing, and all were in heavy shadow. Gaspard found his way precariously to the balcony, pausing once in considerable alarm when a fragment of the worn stone, loosened by his footfall, dropped with a loud clattering on the courtyard flags below. Apparently, it was unheard by the occupants of the castle, and after a little, he resumed his climbing. Cautiously, he neared the large, ragged opening through which the light poured upwards. Crouching on a narrow ledge, which was all that remained of the balcony, he peered in on a most astounding and terrific spectacle, whose details were so bewildering that he could barely comprehend their import till after many minutes. It was plain that the story told by the monks, allowing for their religious bias, had been far from extravagant. Almost the whole interior of the half-ruined pile had been torn down and dismantled to afford room for the activities of Nathair. This demolition in itself was a superhuman task, for whose execution the sorcerer must have employed a legion of familiars as well as his 10 pupils. The vast chamber was fitfully illumined by the glare of athanors and braziers, and above all by the weird glimmering from the huge stone vats. Even from his high vantage, the watcher could not see the contents of these vats, but a white luminosity poured upwards from the rim of one of them, and a flesh-tinted phosphorescence from the other. Gaspard had seen certain of the experiments and evocations of Nathair, and was all too familiar with the appurtenances of the dark arts. Within certain limits, he was not squeamish, nor was it likely that he would have been terrified overmuch by the shadowy, uncouth shapes of demons who toiled in the pit below him side by side with the black-clad pupils of the sorcerer. But a cold horror clutched his heart when he saw the incredible, enormous thing that occupied the central floor. The colossal human skeleton, 100 feet in length, stretching for more than the extent of the old castle hall. The skeleton whose bony right foot, the group of men and devils to all appearance, were busily clothing with human flesh. The prodigious and macabre framework, complete in every part, with ribs like arches of some satanic nave, shone as if it were still heated by the fires of an infernal welding. It seemed to shimmer and burn with unnatural life, to quiver with malign disquietude and the flickering glare and gloom. The great finger bones, curving claw-like on the floor, appeared as if they were about to close upon some helpless prey. The tremendous teeth were set in an everlasting grin of sardonic cruelty and malice. The hollow eye sockets, deep as Tartarian wells, appeared to seethe with myriad mocking lights, like the eyes of elementals swimming upwards in obscene shadow. Gaspard was stunned by the shocking and stupendous phantasmagoria that yawned before him like a peopled hell. Afterwards, he was never wholly sure of certain things, and could remember very little of the actual manner in which the work of the men and their assistants was being carried on. Dim, dubious, bat-like creatures seemed to be flitting to and fro between one of the stone vats and the group that toiled like sculptors, clothing the bony foot with a reddish plasm which they applied and molded like so much clay. Gaspard thought, but was not certain later, that this plasm, which gleamed as if with mingled blood and fire, was being brought from the rosy litten vat in vessels borne by the claws of the shadowy flying creatures. None of them, however, approached the other vat, whose wannish light was momentarily enfeebled as if it were dying down. He looked for the minikin figure of Nether, whom he could not distinguish in the crowded scene. The sick necromancer, if he had not already succumbed to the little-known disease that had long wasted him like an inward flame, was no doubt hidden from view by the colossal skeleton, and was perhaps directing the labors of the men and demons from his couch. Spellbound on that precarious ledge, the watcher failed to hear the furtive, cat-like feet that were climbing behind him on the ruinous stairs. Too late, he heard the clink of a loose fragment close upon his heels, and turning in startlement, he toppled into sheer oblivion beneath the impact of a cudgel-like blow, and did not even know that the beginning fall of his body towards the courtyard had been arrested by his assailant's arms.
5. The Horror of Alorn. Gaspard, returning from his black plunge into Lethian emptiness, found himself gazing into the eyes of Nether, those eyes of liquid night and ebony in which swam the chill, malignant fires of stars that had gone down to irremediable perdition. For some time, in the confusion of his senses, he could see nothing but the eyes, which seemed to have drawn him forth like baleful magnets from his swoon. Apparently disembodied, or set in a face too vast for human cognizance, they burned before him in chaotic murk. Then, by degrees, he saw the other features of the sorcerer and the details of a lurid scene, and became aware of his own situation. Trying to lift his hands to his aching head, he found that they were bound tightly together at the wrists. He was half lying, half leaning against an object with hard planes and edges that irked his back. This object he discovered to be a sort of alchemic furnace, or athanor, part of a litter of disused apparatus that stood or lay on the castle floor. Cupels, aladels, cucurbits, like enormous gourds and globes, were mingled in strange confusion with the piled, iron-clasped books and the sooty cauldrons and braziers of a darker science. Nether, propped among the Saracenic cushions with arabesques of sullen gold and fulgurant scarlet, was peering upon him from a kind of improvised couch made with bales of orient rugs and arases, to whose luxury the rude walls of the castle, stained with mold and mottled with dead fungi, offered a grotesque foil. Dim lights and evilly swooping shadows flickered across the scene, and Gaspard could hear a guttural hum of voices behind him. Twisting his head a little, he saw one of the stone vats, whose rosy luminosity was blurred and blotted by vampire wings that went to and fro.
"Welcome," said Nether, after an interval in which the student began to perceive the fatal progress of illness in the pain-pinched features before him. "So Gaspard du Nord has come to see his former master."
The harsh, imperatory voice, with demoniac volume, issued appallingly from the wizened frame.
"I have come," said Gaspard in laconic echo. "Tell me,
What devil's work is this in which I find you engaged? And what have you done with the bodies that were stolen by your cursed familiars? The frail, dying body of Nathair, as if possessed by some sardonic fiend, rocked to and fro on the luxurious couch in a long, violent gust of laughter, without other reply. "If your looks bear creditable witness," said Gaspard, when the baleful laughter had ceased, "you are mortally ill, and the time is short in which you can hope to atone for your deeds of malice and make your peace with God. If indeed it still be possible for you to make peace, what foul and monstrous brew are you preparing to ensure the ultimate perdition of your soul?" The dwarf was again seized by a spasm of diabolic mirth. "Nay, nay, my good Gaspard," he said finally. "I have made another bond than the one with which puling cowards try to purchase the goodwill and forgiveness of the heavenly tyrant. Hell may take me in the end, if it will, but hell has paid, and will still pay, an ample and goodly price. I must die soon, it is true, for my doom is written in the stars. But in death, by the grace of Satan, I live again, and shall go forth endowed with the mighty thews of the Anakim to visit vengeance on the people of Averoigne, who have long hated me for my necromantic wisdom, and have held me in derision for my dwarf stature." "What madness is this whereof you dream?" asked the youth, appalled by the more than human frenzy and malignity that seemed to dilate the shrunken frame of Nathair, and stream in Tartarian luster from his eyes. "It is no madness, but a veritable thing, a miracle, mayhap, as life itself is a miracle. From the fresh bodies of the dead, which otherwise would have rotted away in charnel foulness, my pupils and familiars are making for me, beneath my instruction, the giant form whose skeleton you have beheld. My soul, at the death of its present body, will pass into this colossal tenement through the working of certain spells of transmigration in which my faithful assistants have also been carefully instructed. If you had remained with me, Gaspard, and had not drawn back in your petty, pious squeamishness from the marvels and profundities that I should have unveiled for you, it would now be your privilege to share in the creation of this prodigy. And if you had come to Alorn a little sooner in your presumptuous prying, I might have made a certain use of your stout bones and muscles, the same use I've made of other young men who died through accident or violence. But it is too late even for this, since the building of the bones has been completed, and it remains only to invest them with human flesh. My good Gaspard, there is nothing whatsoever to be done with you, except to put you safely out of the way. Providentially, for this purpose, there's an oubliette beneath the castle, a somewhat dismal lodging place, no doubt, but one that was made strong and deep by the grim lords of Alorn." Gaspard was unable to frame any reply to this sinister and extraordinary speech. Searching his horror-frozen brain for words, he felt himself seized from behind by the hands of unseen beings who had come, no doubt, in answer to some gesture of Nathair, a gesture which the captive had not perceived. He was blindfolded with some heavy fabric, moldy and musty as a grave cloth, and was led stumbling through the litter of strange apparatus and down a winding flight of ruinous narrow stairs from which the noisome breath of stagnating water, mingled with the oily muskiness of serpents, arose to meet him. He appeared to descend for a distance that would admit of no return. Slowly, the stench grew stronger, more insupportable. The stairs ended. A door clanged sullenly on rusty hinges, and Gaspard was thrust forward on a damp, uneven floor that seemed to have been worn away by myriad feet. He heard the grating of a ponderous slab of stone. His wrists were untied, the bandage was removed from his eyes, and he saw, by the light of flickering torches, a round hole that yawned in the oozing floor at his feet. Beside it was the lifted slab that had formed its lid. Before he could turn to see the faces of his captors, to learn if they were men or devils, He was seized rudely and thrust into the gaping hole. He fell through Erebus-like darkness for what seemed an immense distance before he struck bottom. Lying, half-stunned in a shallow, fetid pool, he heard the funereal thud of the heavy slab as it slid back into place far above him.
6. The Vaults of Alorn. Gaspard was revived, after a while, by the chillness of the water in which he lay. His garments were half-soaked, and the slimy, mephitic pool, as he discovered by his first movement, was within an inch of his mouth. He could hear a steady, monotonous dripping somewhere in the rayless night of his dungeon. He staggered to his feet, finding that his bones were still intact, and began a cautious exploration. Foul drops fell upon his hair and lifted face as he moved. His feet slipped and splashed in the rotten water. There were angry, vehement hissings, and serpentine coils slithered coldly across his ankles. He soon came to a rough wall of stone, and following the wall with his fingertips, he tried to determine the extent of the oubliette. The place was more or less circular, without corners, and he failed to form any just idea of its circuit. Somewhere in his wanderings, he found a shelving pile of rubble that rose above the water against the wall, and here, for the sake of comparative dryness and comfort, he ensconced himself after dispossessing a number of outraged reptiles. These creatures, it seemed, were inoffensive and probably belonged to some species of water snake, but he shivered at the touch of their clammy scales. Sitting on the rubble heap, Gaspard reviewed in his mind the various horrors of a situation that was infinitely dismal and desperate. He had learned the incredible, soul-shaking secret of Alorn, the unimaginably monstrous and blasphemous project of Nether. But now, immured in this noisome hole as in a subterranean tomb, in depths beneath the devil-haunted pile, he could not even warn the world of imminent menace. The wallet of food, now more than half empty, with which he had started from Vionne, was still hanging at his back, and he assured himself by investigation that his captors had not troubled to deprive him of his dagger. Gnawing a crust of stale bread in the darkness and caressing with his hand the hilt of the precious weapon, he sought for some rift in the all-environing despair. He had no means of measuring the black hours that went over him with the slowness of a slime-clogged river, crawling in blind silence to a subterranean sea. The ceaseless drip of water, probably from sunken hill springs that had supplied the castle in former years, alone broke the stillness, but the sound became, in time, an equivocal monotone that suggested to his half-delirious mind the mirthless and perpetual chuckling of unseen imps. At last, from sheer bodily exhaustion, he fell into troubled, nightmare-ridden slumber. He could not tell if it were night or noon in the world without when he wakened, for the same stagnant darkness, unrelieved by ray or glimmer, brimmed the oubliette. Shivering, he became aware of a steady draft that blew upon him, a dank, unwholesome air, like the breath of unsunned vaults that had wakened into cryptic life and activity during his sleep. He had not noticed the draft heretofore, and his numb brain was startled into sudden hope by the intimation which it conveyed. Obviously, there was some underground rift or channel through which the air entered, and this rift might somehow prove to be a place of egress from the oubliette. Getting to his feet, he groped uncertainly forward in the direction of the draft. He stumbled over something that cracked and broke beneath his heels, and narrowly checked himself from falling on his face in the slimy, serpent-haunted pool. Before he could investigate the obstruction or resume his blind groping, he heard a harsh, grating noise above, and a wavering shaft of yellow light came down through the oubliette's opened mouth. Dazzled, he looked up and saw the round hole 10 or 12 feet overhead, through which a dark hand had reached down with a flaring torch. A small basket, containing a loaf of coarse bread and a bottle of wine, was being lowered at the end of a cord. Gaspard took the bread and wine, and the basket was drawn up. Before the withdrawal of the torch and the redepositing of the slab, he contrived to make a hasty survey of his dungeon. The place was roughly circular, as he had surmised, and was perhaps 15 feet in diameter. The thing over which he had stumbled was a human skeleton,
lying half on the rubble heap, half in the filthy water. It was brown and rotten with age, and its garments had long melted away in patches of liquid mold. The walls were guttered and runneled by centuries of ooze, and their very stone, it seemed, was rotting slowly to decay. In the opposite side, at the bottom, he saw the opening he had suspected, a low mouth not much bigger than a fox's hole, into which the sluggish water flowed. His heart sank at the sight, for even if the water were deeper than it seemed, the hole was far too straight for the passage of a man's body. In a state of hopelessness that was like a veritable suffocation, he found his way back to the rubble pile when the light had been withdrawn. The loaf of bread and the bottle of wine were still in his hands. Mechanically, with dull, sodden hunger, he munched and drank. Afterwards, he felt stronger, and the sour, common wine served to warm him and perhaps helped to inspire him with the idea which he presently conceived. Finishing the bottle, he found his way across the dungeon to the low, burrow-like hole. The entering air current had strengthened, and this he took for a good omen. Drawing his dagger, he started to pick with a point at the half-rotten, decomposing wall in an effort to enlarge the opening. He was forced to kneel in noisome silt, and the writhing coils of water snakes, hissing frightfully, crawled across his legs as he worked. Evidently, the hole was their means of ingress and egress to and from the oubliette. The stone crumbled readily beneath his dagger, and Gaspard forgot the horror and ghastliness of his situation in the hope of escape. He had no means of knowing the thickness of the wall or the nature and extent of the subterranes that lay beyond, but he felt sure that there was some channel of connection with the outer air. For hours, or days it seemed, he toiled with his dagger, digging blindly at the soft wall and removing the debris that splashed in the water beside him. After a while, prone on his belly, he crept into the hole he had enlarged, and burrowing like some laborious mole, he made his way onwards, inch by inch. At last, to his prodigious relief, the dagger point went through into empty space. He broke away with his hands the thin shell of obstructing stone that remained. Then, crawling on in the darkness, he found that he could stand upright on a sort of shelving floor. Straightening his cramped limbs, he moved on very cautiously. He was in a narrow vault or tunnel whose sides he could touch simultaneously with his outstretched fingertips. The floor was a downwards incline, and the water deepened, rising to his knees and then to his waist. Probably, the place had once been used as an underground exit from the castle, and the roof, falling in, had dammed the water. More than a little dismayed, Gaspard began to wonder if he had exchanged the foul, skeleton-haunted oubliette for something even worse. The night around and before him was still untouched by any ray, and the air current, though strong, was laden with dankness and moldiness as of interminable vaults. Touching the tunnel sides at intervals as he plunged hesitantly into the deepening water, he found a sharp angle giving upon free space at his right. The space proved to be the mouth of an intersecting passage, whose flooded bottom was at least level and went no deeper into stagnant foulness. Exploring it, he stumbled over the beginning of a flight of upward steps. Mounting these through the shoaling water, he soon found himself on dry stone. The stairs, narrow, broken, irregular, without landings, appeared to wind in some eternal spiral that was coiled lightlessly about the bowels of a lorn. They were close and stifling as a tomb, and plainly they were not the source of the air current which Gaspard had started to follow. Whither they would lead, he knew not, nor could he tell if they were the same stairs by which he had been conducted to his dungeon. But he climbed steadily, pausing only at long intervals to regain his breath as best he could in the dead, mephitis-burdened air. At length, in the solid darkness far above, he began to hear a mysterious, muffled sound, a dull but recurrent crash as of mighty blocks and masses of falling stone. The sound was unspeakably ominous and dismal, and it seemed to shake the unfathomable walls around Gaspard and to thrill with a sinister vibration in the steps on which he trod. He climbed now with redoubled caution and alertness, stopping ever and anon to listen. The recurrent crashing noise grew louder, more ominous, as if it were immediately above, and the listener crouched on the dark stairs for a time that might have been many minutes without daring to go farther. At last, with disconcerting suddenness, the sound came to an end, leaving a strained and fearful stillness. With many baleful conjectures, not knowing what fresh enormity he should find, Gaspard ventured to resume his climbing. Again, in the black and solid stillness, he was met by a sound, the dim, reverberant chanting of voices as in some satanic mass or liturgy, with dirge-like cadences that turned to intolerably soaring paeans of evil triumph. Long before he could recognize the words, he shivered at the strong, malefic throbbing of the measured rhythm, whose fall and rise appeared somehow to correspond to the heartbeats of some colossal demon. The stairs turned for the 100th time in their torturous spiral, and coming forth from that long midnight, Gaspard blinked in the wan glimmering that streamed towards him from above. The choral voices met him in a more sonorous burst of infernal sound, and he knew the words for those of a rare and potent incantation used by sorcerers for a supremely foul, supremely maleficent purpose. Affrightedly, as he climbed the last steps, he knew the thing that was taking place amid the ruins of Alorn. Lifting his head warily above the castle floor, he saw that the stairs ended in a far corner of the vast room in which he had beheld Nathair's unthinkable creation. The whole extent of the internally dismantled building lay before him, filled with a weird glare in which the beams of the slightly gibbous moon were mingled with the ruddy flames of dying Athanors and the coiling, multicolored tongues that rose from necromantic braziers. Gaspard, for an instant, was puzzled by the flood of full moonlight amid the ruins. Then he saw that almost the whole inner wall of the castle, giving on the courtyard, had been removed. It was the tearing down of the prodigious blocks, no doubt through an extra human labor levied by sorcery, that he had heard during his ascent from the subterranean vaults. His blood curdled. He felt an actual horripilation as he realized the purpose for which the wall had been demolished. It was evident that a whole day and part of another night had gone by since his immurement, for the moon rode high in the pale sapphire welkin. Bathed in its chilly glare, the huge vats no longer emitted their eerie and electric phosphorescence. The couch of Saracen fabrics, on which Gaspard had beheld the dying dwarf, was now half hidden from view by the mounting fumes of braziers and thuribles, amid which the sorcerer's 10 pupils, clad in sable and scarlet, were performing their hideous and repugnant rite with its malefically measured litany. Fearfully, as one who confronts an apparition reared up from nether hell, Gaspard beheld the colossus that lay inert as if in cyclopean sleep on the castle flags. The thing was no longer a skeleton. The limbs were rounded into bossed, enormous thews, like the limbs of biblical giants. The flanks were like an insuperable wall. The deltoids of the mighty chest were broad as platform. The hands could have crushed the bodies of men like millstones. But the face of the stupendous monster, seen in profile athwart the pouring moon, was the face of the satanic dwarf Nathair, remagnified 100 times, but the same in its implacable madness and malevolence. The vast bosom seemed to rise and fall, and during a pause of the necromantic ritual, Gaspard heard the unmistakable sound of a mighty respiration. The eye in the profile was closed, but its lid appeared to tremble like a great curtain, as if the monster were about to wake, and the outflung hand, with fingers pale and bluish as a row of corpses, twitched unquietly on the castle flags. An insupportable terror seized the watcher, but even this terror could not induce him to return to the noisome vaults he had left. With infinite hesitation and trepidation, he stole forth from the corner, keeping in a zone of ebon shadow that flanked the castle wall. As he went, he saw for a moment, through bellying folds of vapor, the couch on which the shrunken form of Nathair was lying pallid and motionless. It seemed that the dwarf was dead, or had fallen into a stupor preceding death. Then the choral voices, crying their dreadful incantation, rose higher in satanic triumph. The vapors eddied like a hell-born cloud, coiling about the sorcerers in python-shaped volumes, and hiding again the Orient couch and its corpse-like occupant. A thraldom of measureless evil oppressed the air. Gaspard felt that the awful transmigration, evoked and implored with ever-swelling liturgic blasphemies, was about to take place, had perhaps already occurred. He thought that the breathing giant stirred, like one who tosses in light slumber. Soon, the towering, massively recumbent hulk was interposed between Gaspard and the chanting necromancers. They had not seen him, and he now dared to run swiftly and gained the courtyard unpursued and unchallenged. Thence, without looking back, he fled like a devil-hunted thing upon the steep and chasm-riven slopes below Ilorn.
7. The Coming of the Colossus.
After the cessation of the exodus of liches, a universal terror still prevailed. A wide-flung shadow of apprehension, infernal and funereal, lay stagnantly on Averoin. There were strange and disastrous portents in the aspect of the skies. Flame-bearded meteors had been seen to fall beyond the eastern hills. A comet far in the south had swept the stars with its luminous bosom for a few nights, and had then faded, leaving among men the prophecy of bale and pestilence to come. By day, the air was oppressed and sultry, and the blue heavens were heated as if by whitish fires. Clouds of thunder, darkling and withdrawn, shook their fulgurant lances on the far horizons like some beleaguering Titan army. A moraine, such as would come from the working of wizard spells, was abroad among the cattle. All these signs and prodigies were an added heaviness on the burdened spirits of men, who went to and fro in daily fear of the hidden preparations and machinations of hell. But until the actual breaking forth of the incubated menace, there was no one, save Gaspard du Nord, who had knowledge of its veritable form. And Gaspard, fleeing headlong beneath the gibbous moon toward Vionne, and fearing to hear the tread of a colossal pursuer at any moment, had thought it more than useless to give warning in such towns and villages as lay upon his line of sight. Where indeed, even if warned, could men hope to hide themselves from the awful thing, begotten by hell on the ravished charnel, that would walk forth like the Anakim to visit its roaring wrath on a trampled world? So all that night, and throughout the day that followed, Gaspard du Nord, with the dried slime of the oubliette on his briar-shredded raiment, plunged like a madman through the towering woods that were haunted by robbers and werewolves. The westward falling moon flickered in his eyes betwixt the gnarled somber boles as he ran, and the dawn overtook him with the pale shafts of its searching arrows. The noon poured over him its white sultriness, like furnace-heated metal sublimed into light, and the clotted filth that hung to his tatters was again turned into slime by his own sweat. But still, he pursued his nightmare-harried way, while a vague, seemingly hopeless plan took form in his mind. In the interim, several monks of the Cistercian Brotherhood, watching the gray wall of Ilorn at early dawn with their habitual vigilance, were the first, after Gaspard, to behold the monstrous horror created by the necromancers. Their account may have been somewhat tinged by a pious exaggeration, but they swore that the giant rose abruptly, standing more than waist-high above the ruins of the Barbican, amid a sudden leaping of long-tongued fires and a swirling of pitchy fumes erupted from Malbolge. The giant's head was level with the high top of the donjon, and his right arm, out-thrust, lay like a bar of stormy cloud athwart the new-risen sun. The monks fell groveling to their knees, thinking that the arch-foe himself had come forth, using Ilorn for his gateway from the pit. Then, across the mile-wide valley, they heard a thunderous peal of demoniac laughter, and the giant, climbing over the mounded barbican at a single step, began to descend the scarped and craggy hill. When he drew nearer, bounding from slope to slope, his features were manifestly those of some great devil, animated with ire and malice towards the sons of Adam. His hair, in matted locks, streamed behind him like a mass of black pythons. His naked skin was livid and pale and cadaverous with the skin of the dead, but beneath it, the stupendous thews of a titan swelled and rippled. The eyes, wide and glaring, flamed like lidless cauldrons heated by the fires of an unplumbed pit. The rumor of his coming passed like a gale of terror through the monastery. Many of the brothers, deeming discretion the better part of religious fervor, hid themselves in the stone-hewn cellars and vaults. Others crouched in their cells, mumbling and shrieking incoherent pleas to all the saints. Still others, the most courageous, repaired in a body to the chapel and knelt in solemn prayer before the wooden Christ on the great crucifix. Bernard and Stefan, now somewhat recovered from their grievous beating, alone dared to watch the advance of the giant. Their horror was inexpressibly increased when they began to recognize in the colossal features a magnified likeness to the lineaments of that evil dwarf who had presided over the dark, unhallowed activities of Alorn. And the laughter of the Colossus, as he came down the valley, was like a tempest-borne echo of the damnable cacination that had followed their ignominious flight from the haunted stronghold. To Bernard and Stefan, however, it seemed merely that the dwarf, who was no doubt an actual demon, had chosen to appear in his natural form. Pausing in the valley bottom, the giant stood opposite the monastery with his flame-filled eyes on a level with the window from which Bernard and Stefan were peering. He laughed again, an awful laugh like a subterranean rumbling, and then, stooping, he picked up a handful of boulders as if they had been pebbles and proceeded to pelt the monastery. The boulders crashed against the walls as if hurled from great catapults or mongonels of war, but the stout building held, though shaken grievously. Then, with both hands, the Colossus tore loose an immense rock that was deeply embedded in the hillside, and lifting this rock, he flung it at the stubborn walls. The tremendous mass broke in an entire side of the chapel, and those who had gathered therein were found later, crushed into bloody pulp amid the splinters of their carving Christ. After that, as if disdaining to palter any further with a prey so insignificant, the Colossus turned his back on the little monastery and, like some fiend-born Goliath, went roaring down the valley into Averoigne. As he departed, Bernard and Stefan, still watching from their window, saw a thing they had not perceived heretofore, a huge basket made of planking that hung, suspended by ropes, between the giant's shoulders. In the basket, 10 men, the pupils and assistants of Nathair, were being carried like so many dolls or puppets in a peddler's pack. Of the subsequent wanderings and depredations of the Colossus, 100 legends were long current throughout Averoigne, tales of an unexampled ghastliness, a wanton diabolism without parallel in all the histories of that demon-pestered land. The goatherds of the hills below Alorn saw him coming and fled with their nimble-footed flocks to the highest ridges. To these, he paid little heed, merely trampling them down like beetles when they could not escape from his path. Following the hill stream that was the source of the river's soil, he came to the verge of the great forest, and here, it is related, he tore up a towering, ancient pine by the roots, and snapping off the mighty boughs with his hands, shaped it into a cudgel which he carried henceforward. With this cudgel, heavier than a battering ram, he pounded into shapeless ruin a wayside shrine in the outer woods. A hamlet fell in his way, and he strode through it, beating in the roofs, toppling the walls, and crushing the inhabitants beneath his feet. To and fro in a mad frenzy of destruction, like a death-drunken cyclops, he wandered all that day. Even the fierce beasts of the woodland ran from him in fear. The wolves, in mid-hunt, abandoned their quarry and retired, howling dismally with terror, to their rocky dens. The black, savage hunting dogs of the forest barons would not face him and hid whimpering in their kennels. Men heard his mighty laughter, his stormy bellowing. They saw his approach from a distance of many leagues and fled or concealed themselves as best they could. The lords of moated castles called in their men-at-arms, drew up their drawbridges, and prepared as if for the siege of an army. The peasants hid themselves in caverns, in cellars, in old wells, and even beneath hay mounds, hoping that he would pass them by unnoticed. The churches were crammed with refugees who sought protection of the cross, deeming that Satan himself, or one of his chief lieutenants, had risen to harry and lay waste the land. In a voice like summer thunder, mad maledictions, unthinkable obscenities and blasphemies were uttered ceaselessly by the giant as he went to and fro. Men heard him address the litter of black-clad figures that he carried on his back, in tones of admonishment or demonstration, such as a master would use to his pupils. People who had known Nathair recognized the incredible likeness of the huge features, the similarity of the swollen voice to his. A rumor went abroad that the dwarf sorcerer, through his loathly bond with the adversary, had been permitted to transfer his hateful soul into this titanic form, and bearing his pupils with him, he returned to vent an insatiable ire, a bottomless rancor, on the world that had mocked him for his puny physique and reviled him for his sorcery. The charnel genesis of the monstrous avatar was also rumored, and indeed it was said that the Colossus had openly proclaimed his identity. It would be tedious to make explicit mention of all the enormities, all the atrocities that were ascribed to the marauding giant. There were people, mostly priests and women, it's told, whom he picked up as they fled and pulled limb from limb as a child might quarter an insect. And there were worse things, not to be named in this record. Many eyewitnesses told how he hunted Pierre, the lord of La Frenay, who had gone forth with his dogs and men to chase a noble stag in the nearby forest. Overtaking horse and rider, he caught them with one hand, and bearing them aloft as he strode over the treetops, he hurled them later against the granite walls of the chateau of La Frenay in passing. Then, catching the red stag that Pierre had hunted, he flung it after them, and the huge, bloody blotches made by the impact of the bashed bodies remained long on the castle stone and were never wholly washed away by the autumn rains and the winter snows. Countless tales were told also of the deeds of obscene sacrilege and profanation committed by the Colossus, of the wooden virgin that he flung into the soil above Zymes, lashed with human gut to the rotting, mail-clad body of an infamous outlaw, of the wormy corpses that he dug with his hands from unconsecrated graves and hurled into the courtyard of the Benedictine Abbey of Paragon, of the Church of St. Zenobi, which he buried with its priests and congregation beneath a mountain of ordure made by the gathering of all the dung heaps from neighboring farms. 8. The Laying of the Colossus. Back and forth in an irregular, drunken, zigzag course from end to end and side to side of the harried realm, the giant strode without pause, like an energumen possessed by some implacable fiend of mischief and murder, leaving behind him, as a reaper leaves his swath, an ever-lengthening zone of havoc, of rapine, and carnage. And when the sun, blackened by the smoke of burning villages, had set luridly beyond the forest, men still saw him moving in the dusk and heard still the portentous rumbling of his mad, stormy cachinnation. Nearing the gates of Vionne at sunset, Gaspard du Nord saw behind him, through gaps in the ancient wood, the far-off head and shoulders of the terrible Colossus, who moved along the Azoil, stooping from sight at intervals in some horrid deed. Though numb with weariness and exhaustion, Gaspard quickened his flight. He did not believe, however, that the monster would try to invade Vionne, the especial object of Nathair's hatred and malice, before the following day. The evil soul of the sorceress dwarf, exulting in its almost infinite capacity for harm and destruction, would defer the crowning act of vengeance and would continue to terrorize, during the night, the outlying villages and rural districts. In spite of his rags and filth, which rendered him practically unrecognizable and gave him a most disreputable air, Gaspard was admitted without question by the guards at the city gate. Vionne was already thronged with people who had fled to the sanctuary of its stout walls from the adjacent countryside, and no one, not even of the most dubious character, was denied admittance. The walls were lined with archers and pike-bearers, gathered in readiness to dispute the entrance of the giant. Crossbowmen were stationed above the gates, and mangonels were mounted at short intervals along the entire circuit of the ramparts. The city seethed and hummed like an agitated hive. Hysteria and pandemonium prevailed in the streets. Pale, panic-stricken faces milled everywhere in an aimless stream. Hurrying torches flared dolorously in the twilight that deepened as if with the shadow of impending wings arisen from Erebus. The gloom was clogged with intangible fear, with webs of stifling oppression. Through all this rout of wild disorder and frenzy, Gaspard, like a spent but indomitable swimmer breasting some tide of eternal, viscid nightmare, made his way slowly to his attic lodgings. Afterwards, he could scarcely remember eating and drinking. Overworn beyond the limit of bodily and spiritual endurance, he threw himself down on his pallet without removing his ooze-stiffened tatters, and slept soddenly till an hour halfway between midnight and dawn. He awoke with the death-pale beams of the gibbous moon shining upon him through his window, and, rising, spent the balance of the night in making certain occult preparations which, he felt, offered the only possibility of coping with the fiendish monster that had been created and animated by Nathair. Working feverishly by the light of the westering moon and a single dim taper, Gaspard assembled various ingredients of familiar alchemic use which he possessed, and compounded from those, through a long and somewhat cabalistic process, a dark gray powder which he had seen employed by Nathair on numerous occasions. He had reasoned that the Colossus, being formed from the bones and flesh of dead men unlawfully raised up and energized only by the soul of a dead sorcerer, would be subject to the influence of this powder, which Nathair had used for the laying of resurrected liches. The powder, if cast in the nostrils of such cadavers, would cause them to return peacefully to their tombs and lie down in a renewed slumber of death. Gaspard made a considerable quantity of the mixture, arguing that no mere finger pinch would suffice for the lulling of the gigantic charnel monstrosity. His guttering yellow candle was dimmed by the white dawn as he ended the Latin formula of fearsome verbal invocation from which the compound would derive much of its efficacy. The formula, which called for the cooperation of Alistair and other evil spirits, he used with unwillingness, but he knew that there was no alternative. Sorcery could be fought only with sorcery. Morning came with new terrors to Vion. Gaspard had felt, through a sort of intuition, that the vengeful Colossus, who was said to have wandered with unhuman tirelessness and diabolic energy all night through Averoigne, would approach the hated city early in the day. His intuition was confirmed, for scarcely had he finished his occult labors when he heard a mounting hubbub in the streets, and above the shrill, dismal clamor of frightened voices, the far-off roaring of the giant. Gaspard knew that he must lose no time if he were to post himself in a place of vantage from which he could throw his powder into the nostrils of the 100-foot colossus. The city walls and even most of the church spires were not lofty enough for this purpose, and a brief reflection told him that the great cathedral, standing at the core of Vion, was the only place from whose roof he could front the invader with success. He felt sure that the men-at-arms on the walls could do little to prevent the monster from entering and wrecking his malevolent will. No earthly weapon could injure a being of such bulk and nature, for even a cadaver of normal size, reared up in this fashion, could be shot full of arrows or transfixed by a dozen pikes without retarding its progress. Hastily, he filled a huge leather pouch with the powder, and carrying the pouch at his belt, he joined the agitated press of people in the street. Many were fleeing towards the cathedral to seek the shelter of its august sanctity, and he had only to let himself be borne along by the frenzy-driven stream. The cathedral nave was packed with worshippers, and solemn masses were being said by priests whose voices faltered at times with inward panic. Unheeded by the wan, despairing throng, Gaspard found a flight of coiling stairs that led tortuously to the gargoyle-warded roof of the high tower. Here, he posted himself, crouching behind the stone figure of a cat-headed griffin. From his vantage, he could see, beyond the crowded spires and gables, the approaching giant, whose head and torso loomed above the city walls. A cloud of arrows, visible even at that distance, rose to meet the monster, who apparently did not even pause to pluck them from his hide. Great boulders hurled from mangonels were no more to him than a pelting of gravel. The heavy bolts of arbalests embedded in his flesh were mere slivers. Nothing could stay his advance. The tiny figures of a company of pikemen, who opposed him without thrust weapons, swept from the wall above the eastern gate by a single sidelong blow of the 70-foot pine that he bore for a cudgel. Then, having cleared the wall, the Colossus climbed over it into Vion. Roaring, chuckling, laughing like a maniacal cyclops, he strode along the narrow streets between houses that rose only to his waist, trampling without mercy everyone who could not escape in time, and smashing in the roofs with stupendous blows of his bludgeon. With a push of his left hand, he broke off the protruding gables and overturned the church steeples, with their bells clanging in dolorous alarm as they went down. A woeful shrieking and wailing of hysteria-laden voices accompanied his passing. Straight towards the cathedral he came, as Gaspard had calculated, feeling that the high edifice would be made the special butt of his malevolence. The streets were now emptied of people, but, as if to hunt them out and crush them in their hiding places, the giant thrust his cudgel like a battering ram through walls and windows and roofs as he went by. The ruin and havoc that he left was indescribable. Soon, he loomed opposite the cathedral tower on which Gaspard waited behind the gargoyle. His head was level with the tower, and his eyes flamed like wells of burning brimstone as he drew near. His lips were parted over stalactitic fangs in a hateful snarl, and he cried out in a voice like the rumbling of articulate thunder.
"Oh, ye puling priests and devotees of a powerless god, come forth and bow to Nathair, the master, before he sweeps you into limbo."
It was then that Gaspard, with a hardihood beyond comparison, rose from his hiding place and stood in full view of the raging Colossus. "Draw nearer, Nathair, if indeed it be you, foul robber of tombs and charnels," he taunted. "Come close, for I would hold speech with you." A monstrous look of astonishment dimmed the diabolic rage on the colossal features. Peering at Gaspard as if in doubt or incredulity, the giant lowered his lifted cudgel and stepped close to the tower till his face was only a few feet from the intrepid student. Then, when he had apparently convinced himself of Gaspard's identity, the look of maniacal wrath returned, flooding his eyes with Tartarian fire and twisting his lineaments into a mask of Apollyon-like malignity. His left arm came up in a prodigious arc, with twitching fingers that poised horribly above the head of the youth, casting upon him a vulture-black shadow in the full-risen sun. Gaspard saw the white, startled faces of the necromancer's pupils peering over his shoulder from their plank-built basket.
"Is it you, Gaspard, my recreant pupil?"
the Colossus roared stormily.
"I thought you were rotting in the oubliette beneath Alorn, and now I find you perched atop this accursed cathedral which I'm about to demolish. You had been far wiser to remain where I left you, my good Gaspard."
His breath, as he spoke, blew like a charnel-polluted gale on the student. His vast fingers, with blackened nails like shovel blades, hovered in ogreish menace. Gaspard had furtively loosened his leathern pouch that hung at his belt and had untied its mouth. Now, as the twitching fingers descended towards him, he emptied the contents of the pouch in the giant's face, and the fine powder, mounting in a dark gray cloud, obscured the snarling lips and palpitating nostrils from his view. Anxiously, he watched the effect, fearing that the powder might be useless after all against the superior arts and satanical resources of Nathair. But miraculously, as it seemed, the evil lambents died in the pit-deep eyes as the monster inhaled the flying cloud. His lifted hand, narrowly missing the crouching youth in its sweep, fell lifelessly at his side. The anger was erased from the mighty, contorted mask as if from the face of a dead man. The great cudgel fell with a crash to the empty street, and with drowsy, lurching steps and listless, hanging arms, the giant turned his back to the cathedral and retraced his way through the devastated city. He muttered dreamily to himself as he went, and people who heard him swore that the voice was no longer the awful, thunder-swollen voice of Nether, but the tones and accents of a multitude of men, amid which the voices of certain of the ravished dead were recognizable. And the voice of Nether himself, no louder now than in life, was heard at intervals through the manifold mutterings, as if protesting angrily. Climbing the eastern wall as it had come, the Colossus went to and fro for many hours, no longer wrecking a hellish wrath and rancor, but searching, as people thought, for the various tombs and graves from which the hundreds of bodies that composed it had been so foully reft. From charnel to charnel, from cemetery to cemetery, it went through all the land. But there was no grave anywhere in which the dead Colossus could lie down. Then, towards evening, men saw it from afar on the red rim of the sky, digging with its hands in the soft, loamy plain beside the rivery soil. There, in a monstrous and self-made grave, the Colossus laid itself down and did not rise again. The 10 pupils of Nether, it was believed, unable to descend from their basket, were crushed beneath the mighty body, for none of them was ever seen thereafter. For many days, no one dared to approach the place where the corpse lay uncovered in its self-dug grave. And so the thing rotted prodigiously beneath the summer sun, breeding a mighty stench that wrought pestilence in that portion of Averroine. And they who ventured to go near in the following autumn, when the stench had lessened greatly, swore that the voice of Nether, still protesting angrily, was heard by them to issue from the enormous, rook-haunted bulk. Of Gaspard du Nord, who had been the savior of the province, it was related that he lived in much honor to a ripe age, being the one sorcerer of that region who at no time incurred the disapprobation of the church. You've been listening to The Colossus of Alorn by Clark Ashton Smith. Clark Ashton Smith, 1893 to 1961, was an American author of fantasy, science fiction, and horror stories. Smith is considered one of the big three writers that submitted to Weird Tales alongside H.P. Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard. In addition to writing fiction, Smith was a poet and a talented visual artist, focusing on painting and sculpture in the latter part of his life. You know, it strikes me, listeners, that the tale of the Colossus is similar to the tale of many of the best metal bands. Forged by aggression and malice, one form combined from several that goes forth to cause mayhem as it tours the countryside, and ultimately undone by sniffing too much of the wrong powder. A tale as old as time. And I'm afraid that I've been holding out on you, fellow Colossus aficionados. The music you're hearing right now was written and recorded by none other than yours truly, and it's about this story. Several years back, my friend and colleague Chad Pfeiffer of the Strange Studies of Strange Stories podcast did a fully cast audio drama of this same story and asked me to write some fittingly crushing music. If you'd like to hear that version, you can find it on YouTube as The Colossus by Witch House Media. And for what it's worth, if you want to pick up a copy of this song, it's on my Bandcamp page, vikingguitar.bandcamp.com, and the title is Obliterator. As much fun as it's been, listeners, I'm afraid our time is up. Our Colossus retires to a peaceful end, and we must do the same. Perhaps the true Colossus is the friendship that we formed along the way. Thus concludes Season 13 of Horror Hill, my friends. As today is Thanksgiving, where I'm at, let me take a moment to express how thankful I am to share this show with you all. Not every path would let me read insane escapist fiction like this for a living, and getting to experience it alongside a group of such fine people as yourselves is truly an honor. Please join me next week as we embark on Season 14. And until then, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.